Welcome to the original Gangsters members only. We've been gone for a couple of weeks. We're back, and we're going to be on a pretty steady schedule going into the spring. Novi, thank you for bearing with me as I got some of my traveling in order. I'm headed back to Detroit. Novi was sick for a little bit last month, so we were off of our normal shooting schedule. Thank you for joining me, Novi.
Good evening, Scott. Nice to be here again.
Yep. So, again, hopefully, I know I've been teasing it out for a while, but I'm gonna will it into fruition. We're gonna be unrolling kind of a new lineup format by the spring, or we're into the spring now, but a little bit later in the spring. So I'm excited about that. We're gonna have a couple different people representing different parts of the country to add to Novi. So everybody look forward to that. Today we're gonna go back. No, not back. We're gonna stay in Novi and I's hometown of Detroit. And go back to the 1980s. There have been three things in the news in the last couple of weeks that I want to touch on. One is a death, one is a indictment, and the other is a prison release of somebody that I don't think a lot of people thought would ever see the light of day. So first, Kathy Volson, the Mayor Coleman Young's niece, passed away at 64 years old. Of cancer, and she was the quintessential dope diva. She dated strictly drug kingpins, athletes, and musicians. She was Mayor Coleman Young's favorite niece. He treated her more like a daughter than a niece, and she was really the princess of the city in the 70s and 80s. Novi, tell the audience what you know about Coleman Young, the mayor of Detroit for 20 years, never got convicted of anything, but was hounded by rumors of affiliations to underworld figures and groups his whole time. And I know he had some ties into the Jackalones. Talk about what you knew back in the 70s and 80s when Coleman Young came into power and, you know, the access that people like yourself and your organization could have had to him.
Well, Coleman Young came into power in early 1970s. I believe it was 1972, on the heels of the Irish, couple of Irish mayors, and the 67 riots. Detroit was becoming overwhelmingly a black majority city. Coleman Young was a politician that his campaign was against some of the squads, the specialty squads in the Detroit Police Department that he thought were a bit racist and a bit overzealous. And that's how he got elected. Coleman Young himself was born in the Black Bottom in the east side of Detroit, which was a black neighborhood that was adjacent to the old Italian neighborhoods, the original Italian neighborhoods in Detroit, and eventually spread into those same neighborhoods that the Detroit Italians, as they went up the ladder, the economic ladder, moved over to further east in Detroit, and the blacks moved over. And Coleman Young was a product of that environment. He was a street kid, grew up on the street, became a politician. It was always accessible to elements of the underworld, not personally, but he always had a little hand in. You could get to Coleman Young if you know the right people to go to. Yep. And he was willing to do business, but he didn't. He was a better politician than most because he never put himself directly on the firing line.
He knew how to insulate himself, both politically. Yeah. Criminally, PR-wise, he was somebody that made a lot of friends in backdoor deals that would then insulate him from the stuff that he was doing.
You could make money with Coleman Young. You could get a contract with the city to provide a certain service or product that they needed. And if you knew who to approach, you'd never approach Coleman Young personally, although I did meet him personally more than once. most of the time at the, in the 70s, when he was at the height of his power as mayor, and throughout the 70s, I had a business in the Eastern Market neighborhood, and we saw him often there because it's always been kind of a food mecca in downtown Detroit area. So yeah, I saw him often there. I met him a few times. We shook hands, had lunch once, I believe. But he never approached him directly with a business judgment. He did have connections with the underworld. I believe it is said that his brother ran most of the drugs, or got a piece of most of the drugs running into the city of Detroit.
His brothers and his brother-in-law, Willie Volson, who was Kathy's dad, married to Juanita, who was Coleman's sister, they would handle the payoffs. And I want to differentiate between speculation and fact, even if it's well-sourced, well-educated speculation. Willie Volson, his brother-in-law, would eventually be a convicted. I think he had some criminal issues in his past, but then would go down in the big DPD corruption bust called Operation Backbone that Kathy was used in, and we'll kind of get into that. Like, Kathy didn't realize that she was helping set up a sting to nail her dad and a bunch of Detroit Police Department officers that were close to Coleman Young and Gil Hill. But she was used, as a tool to get that bus. So Willie Volson was convicted. So he's a felon. He's dead, but we can speak about him as a felon. And then the Young family business, before Coleman Young was elected mayor, was Young's Barbecue on the East Side.
Yes.
And the business continued after Coleman Young was mayor. And there were more than one heroin trafficking case that was made out of Young's Barbecue, with relatives of Coleman Young getting tied into the heroin conspiracies that were emanating out of the barbecue spot. So those are facts. Those aren't speculations.
Oh yeah, and I agree with you. Those facts were known around the city.
And Coleman, like Novi said, Coleman came from a background of being a street guy. Yes, he got into politics early, but he always kept one foot on the streets. He was a numbers runner early in his life, was tied up in the policy rackets, I think in the 30s and 40s, I think he got, if anybody in the comments knows, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he got called, and this is more political, I think he got called in front of the House Committee of Un-American Activities for some type of dalliance with the Communist Party in Detroit in the 40s or 50s, where the Black Democrats were mingling with some of the socialists. So there was that kind of mini, I don't want to say scandal, but he had that aspect of his background. And I don't think the heat on him really started until the 80s. He came in, like you said, 72, 73, ruled for 20 years. I mean, he was the mayor for 20 years, from before I was born until I graduated high school.
He was mayor. And I remember when he was elected, and I remember his whole term in office.
He was,
I think, in the very end, I went away for a while.
He was the most powerful mayor I think the city ever had. He wielded that power like a blunt instrument. He, and I guess this is where I'll segue into Kathy. He was protective of not just his family, but also his alleged businesses that weren't all on the up and up. And he according to federal prosecutions that didn't necessarily involve him, but you could look at court filings and whatnot and learn about some of his modus operandi from the city hall, was Kathy herself was married. First, she was engaged to Vinnie Johnson, the microwave, the Pistons world championship. So she was in a relationship with Vinnie Johnson. And then she left Vinnie Johnson for Johnny Curry, who was the biggest East Side drug dealer of really this. He had a pretty long run. About 15 years. He transcended from the marijuana to heroin to cocaine. He hit all three drug eras. And he was a real powerful crime lord in Detroit through, let's say, from 75 to when he went in prison in, I think, 87, 88. And he was married. He married Kathy, I think, in 85, 84. I think he started dating her maybe in 83, 84, married her in 85. The wedding was at the Manoogian Mansion. So just the fact that Coleman Young would host his daughter's wedding to a, at that point, I don't know if he had been convicted, but everybody knew Johnny Curry was a drug kingpin.
Yeah, you're right.
They had the wedding at the mayor's mansion.
Yeah.
That kind of speaks volumes, right?
Yeah, of course it does.
And Johnny had, and this is, again, I want to be clear, because I've had some old school Detroit journalists come up to me over the years and take umbrage with some of my characterizations of Coleman Young with the, well, you know, Scotty was never convicted, so you can't go around calling him a racketeer. And I, in one sense, they're right. But, you know, if it quacks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it acts like a duck, it's a duck.
Well, I wouldn't have classified him as a racketeer. He was a real politician in the old school politician, where you kept your finger in the illegitimate world as long as, and the legitimate world, and that's the way the old politicians did it, it all over this country.
I feel like there was a posture from some of the media in Detroit, and I'm not saying they didn't cover Coleman. I mean, they covered him a lot. But in the, I'm talking more of like the post coverage of his term, and he died pretty quickly after he left office. I think he was only alive for a year or two after he left office. So he didn't really have a, it wasn't like with Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon had, and I know it's a little bit different. Nixon was not the exact same thing, but you know, someone like Nixon had 20 years to kind of go on the PR train and do all these interviews and kind of rehab his image. Coleman Young died pretty quickly after his legacy was cemented. And I feel like, and I'm not going to go too far down this rabbit hole, but sometimes the Detroit media, for being a big city media, they kind of pick their spot sometimes. And I feel like Coleman's been kind of given a free pass by a lot of the mainstream media after the fact, because he was never convicted, where they won't go into some of the obvious aspects of him that were compromised. And but
I'm no fan of Detroit media, but I'm going to defend them a bit here. Coleman Young was enough of a street guy that had enough of upbringing in the streets that he knew how to pick the people around him who did his work for him in that arena, that knew how to keep their mouth shut. And if you want to compare him to another politician who just didn't know how to pick anybody, yeah, was Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
They all just cracked like nuts opening up after they got...
Or Kwame Kilpatrick, who was...
There's another one, Kwame Kilpatrick. He just... He thought he was bigger than Coleman Young, and he should have taken some lessons.
He didn't insulate himself at all.
No, he thought he was running a family in New York City.
Everybody, everything. Kwame Kilpatrick and I know I'm going a little bit down a rabbit hole here, but, and I think I've said this before, but I'll say it again, and I'll say it till the day I die. Kwame Kilpatrick was the biggest gangster in the history of Detroit. Jack Toko, your great, and I say this with respectfully, your great grand or your grandfather, in some ways they had nothing on Kwame, who just, I guess in terms of, not in terms of like overall power, I'm talking about just in the way they went about business. It was so blatant with Kwame Kilpatrick. It was so like, did not try to hide the fact that his, I mean, to the people that knew or the people that were looking, that his city hall was open for business, and anybody that wanted to do business with the city was pay for play.
Yeah, that's what I hear. Now, you got to understand that during Kwame Kilpatrick's term as mayor, when he got himself in all that trouble, I was not in Detroit. I was a guest of the federal government at that time.
So he, for people that aren't from Detroit, Kwame was mayor for a term and a half. Or was it two terms? Might have been, no, two and a half terms, I believe. I digress again. But he got caught in a bribery scandal, in a RICO case. There are people that insist that he had two strippers murdered. And I've seen evidence that at least leans in that direction in terms of breadcrumbs. He was a gangster's gangster that happened to fall or I guess climb his way to the mayor's job. And in the 2000s, it's a different era than it was during Coleman Young. And there are more prying eyes. And I think the difference, frankly, and I think I'm gonna piggyback off one of your points. Coleman Young didn't just pick the right people around him to insulate him from some of the street shit. He knew how to leverage relationships in the media, and he knew how to get certain people to create certain narratives. And Kwame, on the other hand, he got the free press hellbent on taking him down. And those guys won a Pulitzer Prize for taking him down. And it was a multi-year thing where everything he did, he had the free press, and that's the big newspaper in Detroit, on his ass. That never happened with Coleman.
You're absolutely right.
The free press and the news back in Coleman's era, they would cover the federal investigations that were into Coleman, as opposed to what happened with Kwame, where the feds followed the free press. Where like the media was doing all the digging and the feds were making case or trying to make cases and making cases from what the newspaper was doing. Back in the 80s, the newspaper was just doing what the feds were doing or were following what the feds were doing, and the feds were not having success as much as they tried in building cases against Coleman. Therefore, the news and the free press never did hard-hitting, independent, investigative, you know, journalism on Coleman the way Kwame's whole, you know, legacy and tenure as mayor fell apart, landed him in jail.
You're right.
So Kathy, and I'm going to come back now. I know I do the weave here. I weave around subjects, but to go back to the way Coleman insulated himself and insulated the people that he cared about and did business with, Johnny Curry not only had a free line into the mayor's office where he could walk into City Hall and go see Coleman anytime he wanted, he also had a open road into the homicide department with Gil Hill, who was Coleman Young's junkyard dog, who went out and did a lot of his dirty work. And Gil Hill, another person under investigation, but never got arrested. But
he got famous as a movie star.
Right. Got famous as a movie star with Beverly Hills Cop movies. Thought he was going to become a Hollywood star. Thought he was going to become the successor to Coleman. But all the rumors about Gil Hill upended his rise to the mayor's office. Ironically, he was beaten in the race by Kwame Kilpatrick. They went head to head in 2000 or 2001 for the mayor's office, and all the stuff that we're talking about now from the 80s with Gil Hill, even though he didn't get indicted for it, he was investigated. There were grand juries, subpoenas, FBI 302s, surveillance photos, no case, but all that innuendo came up in the election, and Gil Hill was not lost the election. And one of the allegations, and then I'm going to tie this all back to the insulation with Kathy and her husband and the drug dealers on the east side that were being protected by Coleman Young, was they had their own private security being provided by Coleman security. So yeah. Coleman had his private security force, which, again, you want to talk about ironies, the head of Coleman's private security force was Jimmy Harris. Jimmy Harris was the head of the stress unit in the early 70s, who Coleman campaigned
against.
Coleman gets into office, pulls the leader of the group that he gets rid of, and puts a lot of those guys in. A lot of those cops had to go to jail for things that they had done. Pulls Jimmy Harris, makes Jimmy Harris the head of his security detail, and then has Jimmy Harris doing all the dirty work, such as working with Johnny Curry, working with Gil Hill to cover up murders, allegedly. I want to say I don't want Jimmy was never Jimmy was never indicted for any violence, so I want to be clear about that. Gil Hill was alleged to have been covering up murders. Some people said he was putting out murder contracts. Anyway, Johnny Curry, Kathy Curry, and that whole crew had a subfaction of the mayor's security unit that they called the Black Bag Squad, that was in charge of following Johnny Curry around the city with Kathy, protecting him from arrest, giving him the heads up about drug dealers that were trying to move on his territory, going to arrest people that Johnny Curry told them to go arrest to get them away from the scene so he could take their territory. And it was like you had your own mayoral protection unit to do your dirty work because of Kathy's connection to her uncle, who was the mayor. It's insane.
Yeah. There was also a case with that YBI where they were Detroit police were escorting drug dealers.
Right. So this was all happening in the 80s. The YBI.
Yeah, that was all during Coleman Young's term.
Yes. And then I'm going to weave us and I'm going to segue us. I'm going to show everybody my talent as a host. So Kathy and Johnny get jammed up. In a drug case, or I should say, Johnny gets jammed up in a drug case. He goes to jail. The person that basically put him in jail was White Boy Rick Wershey, who was a teenager right out of eighth grade, who a federal drug and corruption task force made up of DPD, FBI, DEA, recruited this 14-year-old kid that had just graduated from eighth grade, was about to start ninth grade at Detroit Denby, which was the neighborhood where Johnny Curry lived. And they convinced him, basically, don't go to ninth grade, forget about high school, and just start going and hang out with Johnny Curry and give us information. So that was a two-year thing where little 14-year-old Rick started to do that and had a lot of success. And then the feds bust Johnny Curry based on the information that White Boy Rick had given them. Johnny Curry goes to prison. In the midst of that, there's a cover-up of a murder of a 10-year-old boy named Damian Lucas, who was killed in a drive-by shooting by Johnny Curry's group. Johnny Curry admits to paying Gil Hill a bribe to get that case thrown out. There's still has not been any resolution to that case 40 years later. And White Boy Rick at that point starts dating Kathy Curry and attempting to take over Johnny Curry's business with Johnny Curry off the streets and locked up. Rick gets locked up shortly thereafter. His attempt to kind of do it by himself didn't really get off the ground that much. And he's locked up. At that point, he's still in a relationship with Kathy Curry, who's in drug rehab. Rick goes back after being estranged from the government, makes another deal with the government, and at that point starts using Kathy with undercover FBI agents to go after the Black Bag Squad and Jimmy Harris and all of his guys that, just what you said, you know, 2 minutes ago, for a decade plus, the Black Bag Squad wasn't just protecting Johnny Curry and Kathy Curry. They were protecting drug dealers and shipments that were coming into town. They would take you, they would escort you from the airport to your drug deal, back to the airport, onto the airplane. And so that all starts to happen in the late 80s. And Rick, in addition to helping them bust the Black Bag Squad, also helps them build a case against the Best Friends, which was the follow-up to YBI. So YBI was the big black, you know, for lack of a better term, black mob or the black drug dealers in the late 70s into the early to mid 80s. Everything was about YBI, Young Boys Incorporated. They sold heroin. And around 84, 85, the move to cocaine and crack cocaine occurs. And then you have a new group of organizations, and maybe the most headline grabbing of those organizations was the Best Friends. And the Best Friends were using the Black Bag Squad in the way that we just talked about. And Rick helps not just bust the Black Bag Squad, but helps them bust the Best Friends. This is going to bring us to the other. Kathy died. RIP to Kathy. I actually got to know her a little bit, and I liked her. She lived quite the life, and lived very quietly in her last, you know, 20 years, a lot different than, let's say, the first 40 years of her life, or where she was very high profile. But so she passed away. But now we have these other two guys from the Best Friends that we haven't heard from really since this period of the 1980s. These guys went away on the case that Rick and Kathy helped build without Kathy knowing she was helping build it. The leader of the Best Friends were the Brown brothers, four brothers, Reggie, Terrence, Gregory, and Ezra. And three of them are gone. They were murdered. The last one standing, Rockin' Reggie Brown, maybe the most infamous of the Brown brothers, somebody that's a suspect in, dare I say, dozens of homicides, convicted of five, was paroled recently. And it really sent shockwaves through the city, at least on the east side, that they would let him out. And he's not in Detroit. He's down in South Carolina. I guess he's trying to, you know, start over and with a clean slate. And I wish him the best. But this was a menace to society in the 80s in Detroit. Rockin' Reg and his three brothers, they killed without a blink of an eye. I mean, their business, more so than dealing drugs, was murder. And it became the way to settle every dispute was settled with a submachine gun. So Rockin' Reg is out. and in South Carolina. And around the same time Rockin' Reg is coming out, Rockin' Reg is one of Rockin' Reg's main hitman. And when you're a hitman's hitman, you know you're a, you know, you're a Stone Cold. A guy named Stacy Colbert, who had gotten out, I believe had gotten out in, at some point in the last 5 years, he had gotten out of a pretty lengthy sentence. All these guys went away in the late 80s, early 90s. And Stacy, Detroit News just did a big story. Stacy got busted, had a trucking company in Grosse Pointe, and was moving kilos of cocaine back and forth to Milwaukee. So I guess I want to, and I just laid it out. What's your take now that, you know, Kathy's gone and, you know, she didn't really do anything to attract headlines the last part of her life. She lived quietly. But these two guys, one has a reputation as big as it can get on the streets of Detroit, at least in the black community, with Rockin' Reg. He's out. Nobody ever thought he was getting out. Five murders. One of those murders, unfortunately, was a three-year-old girl that got caught in the crossfire of him trying to, or of him successfully killing the little girl's uncle. And he's out now after 35 years, 36 years. And then one of his former right-hand men who got out 5 years ago is right back in. What's your take on that?
Well, my take is that doing state time and men getting older, they become a little more mellow and parole comes easier. Also, I wish him well if he's in South Carolina. The thing is that a lot of the period you're talking about, I was not in Detroit, right? Because of 88, I went and did a Fed bit. And then again in 98, I did another Fed bit. So I wasn't in Detroit, and both times I was well aware, I was well away from the Detroit area. So I didn't even see Detroit newspapers at that time. So I'm not aware of a lot of these incidents that you're talking about. I don't remember the case where a little girl gets killed when her uncle gets murdered.
There were so much, Novi, there were so many murders that these best friends were being charged with, that they were, the homicides were coming so frequently that a lot of those kind of tragic circumstances get lost in the flood of violence.
And I do remember a period of time where in the black neighborhoods, in the druggy neighborhoods, there was a lot of murders.
I know that. I hope we should have said that probably at the beginning. In terms of these people we're talking about, Novi, you know, had his interactions with Coleman's people, and Novi's organization had their interactions with Coleman's people. But in terms of Kathy and Johnny Curry and the East Side drug game, by the 80s, pretty much Detroit LCN had left the
black Detroit street, proper.
The Detroit proper, and a lot of those black guys that had at one point in time, if you were a black guy that was doing business in the underworld, you had to, in one way, shape, or other, do business with the Italians.
Oh, that was true in the 50s,
right?
The 60s.
Yes.
But in the 70s, that began to change.
Exactly.
Except, you know, there were some connections to YBI. There were some connections to, this is before the lottery, to the numbers game. And there were connections to illegal gambling, especially on the East Side. And through Allen Hill and some of those guys on the West Side, too, a little bit.
But like you just said, that... even though it wasn't that much of a time gap years-wise, let's say between 1975 and 1985, there was a monumental shift in influence by Detroit LCN in the black neighborhood.
By the LPN time the- had pretty much abandoned the black neighborhoods because they weren't publicly the within the organization, the LCN was saying no drugs. So the guys that were dabbling in it were doing business with the blacks, but they were letting it stay in Detroit.
Right. And they really had nothing, I shouldn't say really, they had nothing to do with the Demetrius Holloway, Chambers Brothers, Maserati Rick, Best Friends era, if you will, yeah. Opposed to the previous YBI era, which they kind of did have a little bit of interaction. But by the time you hit the mid to late 80s, and Novi, like Novi said, he left or he went to prison for a time period in the late 80s. But by that point, when crack was ravaging those neighborhoods, Detroit LCN was not working with the Best Friends. Yeah, I remember asking right. White Boy Rick when I first, and I had a different impression when this was early in my research. I remember sitting down with White Boy Rick the first time. I said, okay, so tell me about your dealings with the Italians. He's like, I didn't have any dealings with the Italians. My only dealings was Bill Buffalino, my attorney. He was my attorney. But he's like, I didn't work with any Italians. He's like, the best friends.
Yeah, White Boy Rick was something that I heard about in the books.
Right.
You know, in the papers when he came up for parole. And the fact that he had Bill Buffalino as an attorney. That's all I knew about White Boy Rick, you know.
So the Best Friends were actively trying to kill White Boy Rick, which is, I'm sure, why Rick was open to, once he started cooperating again, helping them make the case against the Best Friends. I'm going to give a little anecdote, and I'm sure this is not unique, but I want to get Novi's take on it. I know that in the world of being a gangster, there are lots of times when you start off as buddies and you end up trying to kill each other. And I heard some really, I don't know if crazy is the right word, but like, if you study the Brown Brothers and the Best Friends, specifically the four Brown Brothers that led the Best Friends, Rock and Reg, Boogaloo, aka Terrence, Ghost, aka Gregory, and Wizard, aka Ezra, they were like a football team. I mean, they weren't, the Chambers Brothers were tiny guys. Johnny Curry was like slight, like skin. The Best Friend Brown Brothers were, they could all be offensive linemen. They were like six, all of them were like 6'3", 240, 50 pounds. So like they had a presence, you know, about them. And then they're killing so many people. You just have this impression of a bunch of boogeymen, or, you know, like they're not real human beings. And then I start to hear some anecdotes, and I look into some federal court filings and state court filings, and you can see that at one point, the Brown Brothers, or I shouldn't say at one point, Brown Brothers did not come from poverty per se. The Brown Brothers had a middle class upbringing. Their parents were both, their parents were not in the streets. They were legitimate folks. And there are some stories about when the Brown Brothers were, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, they'd have all these people that they eventually would end up going to war with later on. But when they were all between the ages of, say, between 10 and 13, the Brown family is having these people over for like sleepovers and movie nights and come watch the Tigers and we'll make you lemonade and brownies. It's like, I can relate to that as a kid, but I couldn't relate to the second part of it where those four Brown brothers manifest or, you know, evolve into these killers. And then the guys that they have sleeping over their house when they're 10, 11 years old and their mom's making them lemonade and brownies, they're out shooting each other like it's the Wild West on the streets of Detroit.
Well, that's when you go out on the streets, you better, that can happen very easily. People you grew up with could become an enemy very easily. And very seldom does childhood friendship come into it. There are exceptions to the rule, but that's not very often.
And I just think also when you're talking about these, you know, childhood friendships and and where somebody comes from, where their roots are. There are so many, I mean, I would say the most of the time, and you tell me what you think. I would say most of the time, at least when it came to the Italians or the Blacks in this regard, the guys that became criminals came from bloodlines that had criminals. It was more of the exception to the rule when people would come from, and now I think now it's different. Now I think there are people that just want to become gangsters and they come from all different walks of life. But back then, I think it was more rare to come from just a regular run-of-the-mill family that wasn't living in the projects, and then somehow you become these murderous drug kingpin.
Well, I agree with you, but I think too that because of the way the old timers in Detroit and the Italian community encouraged marriages, intermarriages, and things like that, not only was he a childhood friend, he was a blood relative.
Right.
So that tended to eliminate some of the later in life animosities toward each other.
I mean, you had the quote in your wiretap that I saw before I ever knew you. And I'm like, I'm not just saying this, but I was like, this is profound. And you made a comment to Paulie and you said, I don't know how this is all going to end, but my uncle does not want to be 70 years old and shooting it out with his cousins and his nieces and nephews in the streets. Like, that's just not that's not how this thing is built.
That's right. That's not how this thing was built. Right. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
I was paraphrasing what you said, but it was.
Yeah. No, I kind of remember the statement, but you're right. That's true. That's not how it was built. And that's why, so that you don't end up with situations like your childhood friend and you got to go out and kill him.
But let's tie it back to the best friends. They fell apart really internally. Yeah, Rick helped jumpstart it, but the best friend, so the Brown brothers were the leaders. And like I said, they were hitmen, but they also had some of their main lieutenants who were their go-to hitmen. So it was like the hitmen's hitmen. And the three primary hitters that the Brown brothers would give assignments to were Stacy Colbert, who we just talked about, who is now back in trouble, Chucky Wilkes, who cut a cooperation deal, and Nathaniel Boone Craft, who cut a cooperation deal. And Boone Craft was probably the most prolific of those best friend hitmen. He admitted to 35 murders in open court.
Wow.
And the best friends, while they were using Boone to do hits, they killed Boone's brother, which gives Boone the motivation to go cooperate against them. Chucky Wilkes cooperated after he was caught later on, but the case was, I mean, Chucky Wilkes was cooperated after the indictment came down, but the indictment itself was built with White Boy Rick's help and then the insider help coming from Boone Craft. And then talking about, how they fell apart from within, not just from the legal system, but then the indictment comes down, I think in 91 or 92, Boone is in protection at that point. Rick is in protection at that point. And I'm gonna get to the little girl in a moment. And the Brown brothers go on the run. Reggie is caught in New York. There was a FBI U.S. Marshal sting at a luxury car dealership in Manhattan, where they drew the Brown brothers to buy a car, and then they swarmed them. And Reggie got caught, but Boogaloo, so this is something like out of a Denzel Washington movie, Boogaloo grabbed a motorcycle and took the NYPD and the FBI on a chase through the city and ends up getting away. So Rock and Reg is locked up at that point. Boogaloo never made it into handcuffs because Boogaloo's own people, Stacy and Chucky, killed him because they were worried that he had gotten so out of hand and was just so drunk with violence and power that he was eventually going to turn on his own hitmen. So they were all hiding down in Atlanta, and Stacy and Chucky killed Boogaloo while he slept in his hotel suite in 93. So that's an example of how that whole best friends imploded, both in terms of cooperation and then killing Boogaloo. But let's get back to Rock and Reg and how he was, I want to say, allowed to kill this three-year-old girl. And I use the term allowed because Rock and Reg, he fought a bunch of cases. Both Reg and Boogaloo had like numerous murder cases that were being hit, that they were being hit with in 86, 87, 88. And they were beating cases, I'm guessing payoffs, but I don't know for sure. So Rock and Reg is locked up. This is gonna tie a bunch of stuff together, including some of the corruption. Rock and Reg is locked up for killing a guy named Freaky Steve Roussel, who was White Boy Rick's right-hand man. And the murder takes place in September of 87. Rock and Reg is locked up by the winter of 88, goes on trial for Rock and Reg goes on trial for Freaky Steve's murder. I think it was in April. Back then, the trial seemed to happen quick, at least when it comes to the state.
And this the state trials were faster than the Fed trials.
Right. So the murder happens in September of 87, trials in April of 88. Rock and Reg is convicted of killing Freaky Steve. There's some appeal ground on some type of technicality where they're going to, within a couple of weeks of him being convicted, where they're deciding to possibly revisit the case because of an appeal that his attorney had made after the verdict. And they weren't supposed to bond him out because of his background.
Okay.
Someone made a mistake and they bonded him out. And then they didn't see him for 4 years. And in the midst of that bond out, like within, if not within hours, within days of him being bonded out, according to federal prosecutors, he's tipped off by a dirty DPD and a dirty attorney that one of his lieutenants, a guy named Alfred Austin, was going to cooperate. And him and Stacy allegedly go over, I shouldn't say allegedly, Reggie was convicted of it. Allegedly, Stacy and Rock and Reg go to Alfred Austin's house on the east side of Detroit. They all thought Rock and Reg was locked up. They had no idea that Reg had been bonded out. And he shows up at this guy's front porch, and his whole family's out on the front porch barbecuing. And Reg and then allegedly Stacy pull out submachine guns and spray the whole porch. And they kill Alfred Austin. They kill his brother-in-law. They kill another guy, and they kill the three-year-old girl named Lori Roper. And like you said, it didn't really get a ton of press.
Yeah.
You think that would get more press. And then he leaves town, and you don't see him again until the sting in Manhattan in 92. Anyway, Reggie's out now. I'll just give a quick personal story. My only interaction with Reggie. And again, I think this speaks to the corruption that was going on. Now, Reggie was a very violent individual. I don't think that's something that can be disputed. But I think there is a big question about whether or not he killed Freaky Steve Russo. And people that were involved in the conspiracy have told me that Rockin' Reg was not the shooter of Freaky Steve Russo, that he was convicted wrongly. Reggie called me because he knew that I knew that. This was about 5 years ago, maybe more, maybe 6, 7 years ago. And he wanted me to have some people go to Kim Worthy in Wayne County. And I said, I had never spoken to him before. He knew me because he had seen me on television talking about him and stuff. I told him I'd do whatever I could. I mean, I would do what I could do in terms of the people that he wanted me, and I don't want to mention their names, but the people that he wanted me to go tell or pass a message to. I said, I'll pass a message, but I can't make any guarantees past that. Like, I don't know anything. These people know anything. If they want to go on your behalf to the prosecutor, I'll pass word that you want them to do that, but I can't make them do that. So a couple of weeks later, he called me back. Those people had not gone to the prosecutor. He was very angry. And I'll just say that I was a little nervous on the phone. He was very abrasive, a lot of swearing for somebody that I didn't know. And I did what he had asked me to do. So, you know, my impression of him is, at least when I talked to him not that long ago, is the guy was kind of lived up to the reputation, seemed a little unhinged. But that said, I don't believe he killed Freaky Steve Russo. So he was in on a murder that he probably didn't commit. The four people that were killed in that shootout, he also was not convicted of murder. He was convicted of intent to commit murder as an assault charge with those four people. So technically, even though he's being held responsible for the four homicides, technically it's just a intent to commit murder case. So my point is, that's probably why he got let out, even though he was doing a life sentence on these five homicides, but they're kind of...
Yeah, but what does a life sentence mean in the state of Michigan? It doesn't mean life.
Right, it means after 25 years that
you're eligible. Yeah.
He did 36 years, I think.
Yeah, so that's what people don't realize. Life in the state does not mean life. Now, in the feds, you don't get a life sentence. You get... And they don't give it to you in years. They give it to you in months. You might get 685 months or something like that. So, and there is no parole in the Fed system anymore.
Right.
And whatever they give you, you got to do 87.5%. I don't care what you give. You got to jump through hoops to get anything less.
Yep. So, I wish Reggie the best. If he ever wants to talk, if he sees this, I'd love to talk to him. I'd love to interview him. But I'd be lying if I said that people weren't kind of shocked to hear that he had been paroled. Last thing I'll say as we wrap up, and I guess I'm gonna do give a little more of a broadside of the Detroit media, which I guess I'm a part of, but I'm very critical of them. The people that do great work deserve to get accolades, and I give them the accolades. You know, like I said, ML Elric and Jim Schaefer. They got the Pulitzer Prize for taking down Kwame. That was some of the best reporting our city's ever seen. I wish there was more of that kind of energy with some, you know, other things. But again, I digress. But what's interesting about Reggie Brown and his parole, to me at least, in terms of the way it was covered, is that it wasn't covered. The Detroit News and the Free Press were asleep at the wheel. And either they had people working the crime beat that didn't know what to look for, or it just slipped past them. It slipped past me, but I'm not covering Detroit on a daily basis. This is a guy that is one of the most notorious criminals the city of Detroit has ever had, dating back to Prohibition.
And but you're talking about something that occurred 35 or 36 years ago. And some of these journalists just don't have, they're not that old and they don't have that long a memory.
I know, again, I know we're separated by 20 years here. So 20 years is a big difference. But, you know, when White Boy Rick came up for parole in 2004, it was a huge deal. Like, there were cameras everywhere at the parole hearing. There were media reports and investigative reports. It was a spectacle. But I know that was a little bit closer in time, like, to your point. He'd been locked up for less than 20 years at that point. Reggie was locked up for over 30. But it really shocks me that I see that the Detroit News is reporting about Stacey Colbert being arrested in this cocaine case, which, you know, deservedly so, should be covered. But nobody knows who Stacey Colbert is outside of the, you know, the east side of Detroit. Everybody knows who Rock'em Reg is. And I do just a simple Google search, and I can see that his parole hearing was publicized. You know, it was at some point in the last year. But the Free Press and News didn't do a single bit of coverage. I wonder if they had, would he have been paroled so easily? I don't know. But I think that when I just went through the charges, and one was a second degree murder that I don't believe he committed, and the other were intents to commit murder that resulted in a murder, but they weren't straight homicide charges. So I'm guessing that his attorney could kind of finesse that after you do 36 years.
Well, yeah, that does make sense. What you just said makes perfect sense. You did 36 years when the average life sentence is a lot less than that.
And you're not, and the murder that you're actually convicted of has a lot of questions. And then the four other homicides, even though you're legally responsible for the homicides, you're not on the books for murder.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
You're on the books for assault with intent to commit murder.
Correct. Correct.
Well, thank you, Novi, for taking a trip down memory lane, go into the way back machine of the 1980s, the crack era, Coleman Young, Rock and Reggie Brown, the best friends. I enjoyed this.
Okay, Scott.
Novi and I will be back with a second episode this week. We're going to give you a double dose of us. We're going to be having on retired FBI agent Jamie Lawton. We're going to record this tomorrow. Hopefully it will be up by the weekend. And we're going to have a retired FBI agent that made some really big cases on the East Coast against the mafia in Boston, Providence, Connecticut, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh. And he's going to deep dive the NBA and NCAA mafia gambling scandal. He was involved in some of the latter part of the Goodfellas, Pittsburgh, Boston College mafia point shaving that they talk about in Goodfellas, and all those Henry Hill and Jimmy the Gent. They were fixing games at Boston College out of Pittsburgh. And early in Jamie's career, he was dealing with some of those guys. But Jamie's got great perspective, and it'll be fun. Me, Novi, and Jamie are going to chop it up. So look forward to that. Thank you, Novi. Hope you have a great rest of the evening. I'm making my way back to Detroit. I'm in Utah right now. I'm going to go see some of the sites, and I'm reconvening with Novi tomorrow afternoon. Novi, thank you so much.
Okay, Scott, you take care, and thank you for having me again.
Yep, and hope everybody out there enjoys this fresh content. I promise we're going to be giving you some really cool stuff coming up. Look forward to it. Thank you, Novi. Thank you to Benny behind the glass. Original Gangsters, members only. We are out.